It is worth noting also the day of this feast celebrated by the whole nation, for it is held on the 14th of the month, a number made up of two sevens, so that it should not lack any of the honor due to the number seven, but that this number should preside over the whole occasion with its distinction and solemnity. Following the crossing feast comes a festival with a distinctive character and an unaccustomed use of food, unleavened bread, from which it takes its name. There is a twofold account of it, one particular to the nation, on account of the migration already mentioned, the other general, according to the sequence of nature and the harmony of the whole universe. That this claim is no falsehood must now be examined. This month, seventh in number and order according to the solar cycle, is first in importance, and for this reason it is recorded first in the sacred books. The reason, I think, is this. The vernal equinox has come to be a kind of image and imitation of that beginning at which this world was fashioned. For then, as the elements were being separated out and taking on their harmonious order in relation both to themselves and to one another, the heaven was being adorned with the sun and moon, and the choruses and cycles of the other planets and fixed stars, and the earth too was being adorned with every kind of plant, and all the rich and deep soil of both the hill country and the plain was in flower and putting forth green growth. So each year, by way of reminding us of the world's coming into being, God brings forth the spring, in which everything blooms and buds. It is therefore not without purpose that this month is recorded first among the laws, since it is in a way an impression of that first beginning, stamped from it as from an archetypal seal. But the month that falls at the autumnal equinox, though it too is first in the solar cycles, is not called first in the law, because at that time, once all the crops have been gathered in, the trees shed their leaves, and everything that the flourishing spring had brought forth withers and dries up under the dry winds of the air, which turn parched from the sun's scorching. To designate as first, then, a month in which both the hill country and the plain are barren and unfruitful, he judged to be altogether discordant and unfitting. For what has been allotted, the first and leading rank must be attended by the most beautiful and desirable things, those through which living creatures, crops, and plants come into being and grow, and not by the ill-omened processes of decay. The festival begins at the mid-month, the 15th day, when the moon becomes full, by the providential design that on that day there should be no darkness at all, but everything filled with light through and through. The sun shining from morning until evening, and the moon from evening until morning giving the same, the two lights yielding their place to one another in unshadowed brightness. The festival is then kept for 7 days, since the number seven has been allotted preeminence and honor in the world, so that nothing that belongs to good cheer, to the joy and thanksgiving of the whole people toward God, should be missing from the sacred week, which he intended to be the beginning and source of all good things for humankind. Of the 7 days he called two, the first and the last, holy, giving distinction, as is fitting, to the end as well, and at the same time wishing, as in a musical instrument, to bring the boundary notes into harmony with one another, and perhaps also wanting to make both the time past and the time to come concordant with the festival, joining the past to the first day and the future to the last, each of which has taken on the force of the other. For the first day is the beginning of the festival, but the end of the time that has gone by, while the seventh is the end of the festival, but the beginning of the time to come. So that, as I said before, the whole life of the virtuous person may be reckoned a festival of equal honor, once it has driven out grief, fear, desire, and the other passions and sicknesses of the soul. The bread is unleavened, either because our ancestors, when by divine escort they were setting out on that migration, in their utmost haste carried with them dough made without leaven, or because at that season, I mean the season of spring, in which it happens that the festival is kept. The crop of grain is not yet complete, the fields bearing ears but not yet ready for the harvest. It was to the crop still incomplete, but soon, a little later, to reach completion, that he judged it right to liken this unleavened food. For it too is incomplete, as a reminder of a good hope, since nature is already preparing her yearly gifts to the human race in the abundance and plenty of what is needed. It is also said by the expositors of the sacred writings that unleavened food is a gift of nature, while leavened food is a work of art. For through the pursuit of pleasure, striving to mix the pleasant with the necessary, men have by art rendered smooth what by nature was austere. Since then, the spring festival is, as I have shown, a memorial of the world's coming into being. And since the most ancient people, born of the earth and from earth-born parents, necessarily made use of the world's gifts unaltered, pleasure not yet having gained the upper hand, he ordained as the food proper to that season, wishing every year to kindle afresh the embers of a solemn and austere way of life, and at the same time, in the truce of the festival, to marvel at and honor the ancient life of frugality and simplicity, and to make our own life, so far as possible, resemble that ancient one. What has been said is confirmed above all by the setting out, on the sacred table, of 12 loaves equal in number to the tribes, for all of them are unleavened, a most evident sign of food unmixed, prepared not by art for pleasure, but by nature for necessary use. So much then on this. There is a festival within the festival, the one that falls immediately after the first day, which is named, from what is done, the sheaf. For this is brought to the altar as a first fruit both of the land, which the nation has been allotted to inhabit, and of the whole earth, so that the first fruit is at once the nation's own and common on behalf of the whole human race. The reason is that the relation a priest bears to a city, the nation of the Jews bears to the whole inhabited world. For it acts as priest, if the truth must be told, employing all the purifications proper to holiness, both of body and of soul, under the guidance of divine laws which have restrained the pleasures of the belly and those below it, and have bridled the unruly mass of the soul, giving reason as charioteer over the irrational senses, and have checked and reined in the soul's unjudged and excessive impulses, some by gentler instruction and philosophical exhortation, others by weightier and sterner rebukes, and by fear of the punishment they hold in store. Apart from the fact that the legislation is, in a sense, a teaching in priesthood, and that whoever lives according to the laws is at once a priest, or rather a high priest, in the judgment of truth, there is this further distinguished point. Unbounded and uncontainable has proved to be the multitude of God's honored city by city, male and female, whom the race of poets and the mass of men have fashioned into myths, men for whom the search for truth is impassable and unexplored. And indeed not all honor the same gods, but different peoples hold different ones in reverence and worship, so that they do not even recognize as gods those of a foreign land, but treat the acceptance given them as a laughing matter and mockery, and condemn as great folly those who honor them, as men who have missed a sound judgment. But if there exists, as with one accord all agree, both Greeks and barbarians together, one who is the highest father of gods and men and the maker of the whole universe, whose nature, being invisible and hard to conceive, all who occupy themselves with the sciences and the rest of philosophy long to search out, not only to see but even to comprehend by thought, leaving nothing undone toward its discovery and its worship, then all men ought to have been bound fast to him, and not, as though summoned in from a stage machine, to induct others into equal honors. But since they stumbled in the most necessary part, the nation of the Jews, to speak in the most proper terms, set right the failure of the rest, passing over everything that has come into being as generated and by nature perishable, and choosing the worship of that alone which is ungenerated and eternal. First because it is noble, and then because it is also profitable to honor the elder before the younger, the ruler before the ruled, and the maker before what has come into being. These are truths that stand and are to be held fast. Hence it occurs to me to marvel how some dare to accuse this nation of misanthropy, when it makes use of such an excess of fellowship and goodwill toward all people everywhere, that it offers prayers, festivals, and first fruits on behalf of the common race of men, and worships the truly existent God both for itself and for the others who have run away from the service they owe. This, then, is on behalf of the whole human race. But privately, again, they give thanks for many things. First, because they do not go on wandering scattered over land and sea, and, as strangers without a settled place, are not reproached for occupying the goods of others and lying in wait for what belongs to other men, having borrowed no portion of so much land in order to be resettled, but having acquired territory and cities, they possess for a long time now their own allotted portion, out of which it is a holy duty to offer first fruits. Second, because the land they were allotted is not a rejected or ordinary one, but good and all-bearing, suited both for the fruitful breeding of tame animals and for the boundless abundance of crops. For in it there is no poor soil, but even what seems rocky and hard is girded with soft and very deep veins, which, because of their richness, are good for nurturing life. Furthermore, they did not receive a deserted land, but one in which there was a populous nation and great cities thriving with men. Yet these cities were emptied of their inhabitants, and the whole nation, apart from a small remnant, was destroyed, in part by wars, in part by God-sent visitations, on account of the strange and monstrous practices of wrongdoing and the impieties they committed in their great undertakings against the ordinances of nature, so that those who came to settle in their place might be schooled by the evils of others, taught by the facts themselves that those who become zealots of the works of wickedness will suffer the same fate. While those who honor virtue will possess the allotted portion given them, examined not as resident aliens, but as native-born. That the sheaf, then, is a first fruit both of the nation's own land and of the whole earth, offered in thanksgiving for the prosperity and good harvest which the nation and the whole human race long to enjoy, has now been shown. But one should not fail to note that many, and most beneficial, things present themselves through the first fruit. First, remembrance of God, than which no more perfect good can be found, and then, a most just recompense to him who is, in truth, the cause of the good harvest. For what comes from the farmer's art is little, or rather nothing. To open furrows or dig round a plant and mound it, or deepen a trench, or cut away superfluous growths, or do some other such task, whereas everything necessary and useful comes from nature. The most fertile soil, regions well watered by native springs and rivers, by winter torrents and the yearly rains, a good tempering of the air breathing with its most life-giving breezes, and the countless forms of seed crops and plants. Which of these has man either discovered or produced? Nature, then, who gave birth to these, has not begrudged man her own good things, but deeming him the most commanding of mortal creatures because he has a share in reason and understanding, chose him as of the highest merit and called him to partake in what is her own, for which the host, God, deserves to be praised and marveled at, who provides the earth, the truest hearth, always full not only of what is necessary, but also of what belongs to a life of refined ease. Besides this, there is the duty not to be unreasoning. For he who has grown accustomed to gratitude toward God, who lacks nothing and is full in himself, will surely have become accustomed to it toward men too, who are in need of countless things. The sheaf of the first fruit is of barley, for the blameless use of those of lesser station. For since it was not pure and holy to offer first fruits from everything, most things having come into being more for pleasure than for necessary use, nor was it lawful to enjoy and partake of any food meant for eating without having first given thanks in the manner that is fitting and right, the law ordained that the offering of first fruits be made from the kind of food honored with second place, barley. For the crop of wheat has won the seniority, and its first fruit, being the more distinguished, he assigns to a more fitting season, not sending it forth prematurely, but storing it up for the present time, so that acts of thanksgiving might be fitted to their appointed periods of time. Possessing so many privileges as the law has shown, the festal gathering held over the sheaf is, if we are to speak the truth, a festival preliminary to another and greater festival. For from that day the 50th day is reckoned by 7 weeks, the unit that seals a sacred number of release, which is the bodiless image of God, to whom it is made like through its solitary oneness. This, then, is the first beauty that the number 50 displays. Another point must be mentioned. The nature of this number is marvelous and worth contending for, among other reasons, because it is composed of the most elemental and most venerable of the things comprised within substances, as the mathematicians say, the right-angled triangle. For the sides of this triangle, being 3, 4, and 5 in length, complete the number 12, the model of the zodiacal circle, by the doubling of the 6, the most fruitful number, which is the beginning of perfection, being completed out of its own parts, to which it is equal. But in power, it seems, they beget the 50th, through 3 × 3, 4 × 4, 5 × 5, so that one must necessarily say that the 50 is as much greater than the 12 as the power is greater than the length. But if the fairest of the spheres in heaven, the zodiacal, is the image of the lesser number, of what could the greater number, the 50, be the model, if not altogether of some better nature? Of this it is not the occasion to speak. For the present it is enough to have noted the difference, so as not to treat as incidental a matter that ought to take the lead. The festival that falls on the 50th number has received the name of first fruits, on which it is customary to offer 2 leavened loaves made of wheat as the first fruits of grain, the finest of foods. It was named of first fruits either because, before the year's crop comes into use for human beings, the first offspring of the new grain and the first crop to appear are brought as a first fruit offering. For it is just and pious that those who have received from God the greatest gift, abundance of food that is at once most necessary, most beneficial, and also most pleasant, should neither enjoy it nor taste it at all before offering first fruits to its provider, giving him nothing, for all things. Both possessions and gifts are his, but through a small token displaying a grateful and God-loving disposition toward him who, needing no favors himself, waters us with continuous and unfailing favors. Or, because the crop of wheat is, above all, the first and best offspring, the other sown crops being ranked in second place. For just as a ruler is said to be first in a city, and a pilot first on a ship, because the one leads and takes precedence in the city, the other on the ship. In the same way, the crop of wheat too was named by a compound word, first offspring, because it is best of all things sown, for it had to be food for the best of living creatures as well. The loaves are leavened, since the law forbids bringing leaven up to the altar, not so that there might be some conflict among its commands, but so that in a certain way, through a single kind of offering, one might both receive and give. Receive the thanksgiving from those who bring it, and give back at once, without delay, the offerings to those who brought them, yet not so that they might make ordinary use of them. For they will make use of things once they have been consecrated, of what it is lawful and permitted to use. And it is lawful for the priests, who have received a share in whatever is brought to the altar and not consumed by the unquenchable fire, a share given by the law's kindness to humanity, either as wages for their services, or as a prize for the contests they undertake on behalf of piety, or as a sacred allotment, since in the land they did not, like the other tribes, receive by lot the portion falling to them. Leaven is also a symbol of two other things. One, of the most complete and whole nourishment, than which none better or more useful can be found in daily use. And the crop of wheat is likewise the strongest among sown crops, so that it is fitting that the best first fruit be made from the best food. There is another, more symbolic reason. Everything leavened is raised up, and joy is a reasonable raising up of the soul. Man by nature rejoices at nothing more than abundance and plenty of necessities. For these, it is right to give thanks while rejoicing, making the invisible well-being of the mind perceptible through the thanksgiving of the leavened loaves. The first fruit offering consists of loaves, not of wheat itself, because nothing further is lacking for the enjoyment of food once the wheat has been made into bread. For it is said that of all sown crops, wheat by nature is the last to be produced and the last to come to harvest. There are two best forms of thanksgiving for two periods of time. For the past, in which we did not experience the evils of want and famine, but passed our days in prosperity. And for the future, because we have made ready the provisions and preparations for it, and, full of good hopes, we store up the gifts of God, bringing them forward each day for our daily sustenance, as much as is needed according to the laws of household management as a virtue. Next comes the sacred month festival, during which, together with the sacrifices offered, it is customary to sound trumpets in the temple. From this, it is properly called the Feast of Trumpets, and it has a twofold meaning, one particular to the nation, the other common to all mankind. The particular meaning is a reminder of a portentous and mighty deed, at the time when the oracles of the laws were being proclaimed. For then a voice of a trumpet sounded from heaven, which was likely to reach even to the ends of the universe, so that even those not present, dwelling almost at the very extremities, might be turned by the awe caused by that event, reasoning, as was likely, that things so great are signs of great accomplishments. And what could come to mankind greater or more beneficial than the general laws, which God proclaimed as a prophet, not through an interpreter, as he did the particular ordinances? This is the meaning peculiar to the nation. But that which is common to all mankind is this. The trumpet is an instrument of war, both for the charge against enemies, whenever it is time to engage in combat, and for recall, whenever armies returning to their own camps need to be distinguished from the enemy. But there is also another war, driven by God, whenever nature is in strife within herself, her parts set against one another, when the most lawful equality is overpowered by the greed of inequality. By both these wars, the things of earth are destroyed. By enemies, through the cutting down of trees, ravaging and burning of crops and grain-bearing fields. By the workings of nature, through droughts, floods, the violence of south winds, scorching by the sun and freezing snow, when the harmony of the yearly seasons turns into disharmony. Because of, I think, the impiety that spreads not little by little but pours out in a sudden flood, wherever such things occur among men. For this reason, the law appointed a festival named after the trumpet, an instrument of war, as an act of thanksgiving to the God who makes and guards peace, who, by removing the factions both in cities and among the parts of the universe, has produced prosperity and abundance and plenty of other good things, allowing no spark of destruction to the crops to be kindled into flame. After the Feast of Trumpets comes the fast, a festival. Perhaps someone of those who hold different views and are not ashamed to disparage what is good might ask, what kind of festival is it in which there are no banquets, no common meals, no gathering of hosts and guests, no abundance of unmixed wine, no lavish tables, no supplies and preparations for a public feast, no merriment and revels with games and jesting, no play accompanied by flute and lyre and drums and cymbals, and all the other things which, belonging to the effeminate and softened kind of music, stir up unrestrained desires through the ears. In these things and through these, it seems, people set their idea of rejoicing in ignorance of true joy. This the all-wise Moses, seeing with the sharpest of eyes, declared the fast to be a festival and the greatest of festivals, calling it in his ancestral tongue, Sabbath of Sabbaths. Or, as the Greeks would say, a week of weeks and holier than the holy, for many reasons. First, on account of self-mastery, which he always commands us to display in all matters of life, in what concerns the tongue and the belly and what is below the belly, but now bids us observe with special care, having set apart an exceptional day for it. For anyone who has learned to disregard food and drink, things so necessary, would he not look down on any of the superfluous things which have come to be not for the sake of survival and preservation, but for the sake of the most harmful pleasure? Second, because the whole day is devoted to prayers and supplications, people from dawn to dusk having leisure for nothing else but the most earnest prayers, by which they strive to make God gracious, asking pardon for sins both willing and unwilling, and hoping for good things, not on their own account, but because of the merciful nature of Him who sets forgiveness before punishment. Third, because of the season in which the fast happens to be held, for by this time everything that the earth has produced through the year has already been gathered in. To gorge oneself at once on what has been produced, he considered a work of insatiable greed, but to fast and abstain from food entirely a work of complete piety, which teaches the mind not to trust in what has been prepared and made ready as the cause of health or life. For these things, even when present, have often done harm, and when absent, have done good. Nearly as if speaking outright, even if they utter no sound at all, those who abstain from food and drink after the gathering of the crops cry out with their souls and say this: we have received the gifts of nature gladly and we store them up. But we never ascribe to anything perishable the cause of our survival, but to the begetter and father and savior of both the cosmos and the things within it, God, whom it is right to thank, both through these things and apart from them, for nourishing and preserving us. Behold, indeed, our own ancestors too, in their many tens of thousands, passing their life through a trackless and utterly barren desert for 40 years, he nourished as though in the deepest and most fertile land, cutting open springs then for the first time for abundant use of drink, and raining down food from heaven neither more nor less than sufficed for each day, so that, using necessities that could not be stored up, they might not sell for lifeless things, whatever they might have hoarded up, their good hopes. But caring little for the things provided, might marvel at and worship the Provider, and honor Him with fitting hymns and proclamations of blessedness. The day of the fast is held, by the law's command, always on the 10th of the month. And why on the 10th? As we have set out precisely in the discourses concerning it, it is called by wise men complete perfection. For it contains within itself all the proportions, the arithmetical, the harmonic, and the geometric, and moreover the harmonies. The fourth in the ratio of 4 to 3, the fifth in the ratio of 3 to 2, the octave in the ratio of 2 to 1, and the double octave in the ratio of 4 to 1. It also has the ratio of 9 to 8, so that it is the most perfect fulfillment of the principles of music, from which it has also been named complete perfection. So the law's command is that the abstinence which is fasting must be observed each year on the 10th day of the month, always at the sacred food taking. He has prescribed that the deprivation of food and drink take place according to the perfect and complete number of 10, for the sake of the best nourishments of the best part in us, so that no one should suppose that the high priest is introducing famine, the most unbearable of all evils, but rather a brief check on the influx that streams toward the body's receptacles. For in this way, the stream from the rational spring was meant to flow smoothly into the soul, clear and pure, since continual and successive feedings, flooding the body, drag down reasoning along with it. Whereas if they are held back, the soul, firmly grounded as on a dry and open road, will be able to make its journey without stumbling, reaching after the things worthy of sight and hearing. It was fitting, besides, that once all things had gone according to plan toward abundance, arriving at perfect and complete goods, people should take, amid prosperity and plenty of supplies, a reminder of want, through abstaining from food and drink, and should offer prayers and supplications, both so as not to come to a genuine trial of need for necessities, and also in thanksgiving, because in the midst of abundant goods they remember evils that never came to be. So much, then, for this. The last of the yearly festivals is the one called Tabernacles, whose season is that of the autumn equinox, from which two things follow: that those who hate inequality must honor equality, for equality is the origin of justice, while inequality is the origin and source of injustice, and the one is kin to unshadowed light, the other to darkness. And that, after the completion of all the fruits, it is fitting to give thanks to the God who brings all things to completion and is the cause of every good. For autumn, as indeed its very name shows, is the season after the ripe fruit has already been gathered in, and after the seeded crops and all the produce the earth has yielded for the countless kinds of living creatures, tame and wild, have brought in their yearly tribute and their necessary due, abundantly supplied not only for present and momentary enjoyment, but also for the future, owing to the forethought of a nature that loves living things. And indeed the command is to spend the time of this festival dwelling in tabernacles, either because there is no longer any need to live out in the open working the fields, since nothing has been left outside, but all the fruits are stored away in pits and places of that kind against the usual damages that follow from the sun's scorching and the onrush of rains. For when the crops that sustain you are still in the fields, you must not shut yourself away like a woman confined to her chamber, but go out as their overseer and guard of what is necessary. And if, while you remain in the open, cold and heat assail you, there are the leafy shade trees standing by, under whose cover you can easily escape harm from either extreme. But when all the fruits have been brought in, you go indoors too, to reach a more sheltered way of living, for rest from the labors you endured while working the land. Or else the command is meant as a reminder of the ancestors' long journey, which they made through a vast wilderness, dwelling in tents for many years at each stopping place. It is fitting, too, to remember poverty in the midst of wealth, and obscurity in the midst of fame, and a private station in the midst of positions of rule, and the dangers of war in time of peace, and storms at sea while on land, and desolation while in the midst of cities. For there is no greater pleasure than to keep, in the midst of great prosperity, a recollection of former misfortunes. And beyond the pleasure, no small benefit for the practice of virtue arises as well. For having set before their eyes both the better and the worse condition, and having thrust away the one while enjoying the fruit of the better, people necessarily become grateful in disposition and are spurred on toward piety by fear of a change to the opposite state. Hence, even in the midst of present goods, they honor God with songs and words, and beg that they may never again be tried by evils, and win his favor with supplications. Again, the beginning of this festival falls on the 15th of the month, for the same reason given in the case of the spring season, so that the world may be full, not only by day, but also at night, of light that is by nature altogether beautiful, sun and moon on that day rising opposite each other with unbroken rays, between which no darkness draws a dividing line. After 7 days, he seals it with an eighth, which he calls the closing festival, not, it seems, of that festival alone, but of all the yearly festivals he has numbered and gone through, for it is the last of the year and its conclusion. Perhaps, too, the first cube, the number 8, was assigned to this festival for the following reason. It is, in its potential, the beginning of solid substance according to the transition from things incorporeal, but the conclusion of the intelligible, and the intelligible realities, by their successive increases, move towards solid nature. And indeed the autumn festival, as I said, appears to be a kind of fulfillment and conclusion of all the festivals within the year, more settled and stable than the rest, since people have already received the produce of the land and no longer wander in uncertainty and fear over whether the harvest will fail or succeed. For the anxieties of farmers remain unfixed until the crops have been gathered in, on account of the losses that lie in wait from countless quarters, affecting both people and livestock. I have dwelt on these matters at greater length because I wish to show, with regard to the sacred seventh, that all the yearly festivals turn out to be, so to speak, offspring of the 7-day period as a mother follies and joys, and because in festal gatherings and a cheerful life there arise delights untouched by gloom and dejection, which relax both bodies and souls, the bodies through luxurious living, the souls through the practice of philosophy. There is, alongside these, a certain gathering that is not exactly a festival of God, but a festal assembly connected to a festival, which they call the basket, from what happens at it, as I shall shortly explain. That it does not have the rank and order of a festival is clear from many considerations. It does not belong to the whole nation in common, as does each of the others, nor is anything brought or offered at it consecrated on the altar and given over to the undying and sacred fire, nor has any number of days been fixed on which it must be kept as a festival. Yet one could easily see that it has a festal character and stands close to the license of a festal gathering. For each person who owns fields and property having filled vessels, which, as I said, they call baskets, with each kind of tree fruit, brings the first fruits of the good harvest to the temple in joy, and standing before the altar gives them to the priest, reciting the beautiful and wonderful song, or, if he happens not to remember it, listening to it from the priest with the closest attention. The song runs as follows. The founders of our race left Syria and moved to Egypt. Being few in number, they grew into a multitude of a nation. Their descendants, suffering countless wrongs at the hands of the local people, with no help any longer appearing from human quarter, became suppliants of God, taking refuge in the help that comes from him. He who is kindly disposed toward all who suffer injustice accepted their supplication, struck those who attack them with terror through signs and wonders and apparitions and all the other marvels wrought at that time, and rescued those who were being maltreated and who endured every kind of plot, not only choosing them out into freedom, but also giving them a land bearing every kind of produce. From the fruits of this land, O benefactor, we bring you the first fruits, if indeed it is right to say that one brings anything to the one who is the giver. For yours, Master, are the graces and the gifts, all of them, in which we take pride and rejoice, being counted worthy of unlooked-for goods, which you gave us though we had not hoped for them. This song is sung, without interruption, by one group after another, from roughly the beginning of summer to the end of autumn, over 2 seasons together making up a whole half of the year, because it is not possible for everyone all at once, by a fixed deadline, to bring in the right produce, but different people do so at different times, and sometimes even the same people from the same places. For since some fruits ripen sooner and others later, and this is so both because of differences in locality, some being warmer, some colder, and for countless other reasons, it is reasonable that the time for the first fruit offering of tree fruits is undefined and unbounded, extending over a very long span. the use of these offerings has been entrusted to the priests, since they were allotted no portion of land nor any revenue-bearing property. But their inheritance is the first fruits from the nation, in place of the services they perform by day and by night. So much, then, have I set out concerning the seven-day period and the things connected to it in days, months, and years, and concerning the festivals that have kinship with the number seven, following the sequence of the topics laid out at the start, in the order the discussion requires. I shall next examine the topic that comes after, which has been written concerning the honor due to parents. On the honor due to parents. Having first spoken of four kinds, which were truly first in both order and power, that concerning the sole rule by which the world is ruled as a monarchy, and that concerning the making of no image or likeness of God, and that concerning not swearing falsely or, in general, swearing in vain, and that concerning the sacred seventh day, all of which tend toward piety and holiness. I now pass on to the fifth, concerning the honor due to parents, which, as I showed in my separate treatise on the subject, stands on the boundary between things human and things divine. For parents occupy a place between divine and human nature, partaking of both. Of human nature, clearly, in that they have come into being and will perish. Of divine nature, in that they have begotten and have brought what did not exist into existence. For what God is to the world, this, I think, parents are to their children, since just as he brought existence out of what did not exist, so two parents, imitating his power so far as they are able, immortalize the race. Father and mother are worthy of honor not only for this reason, but for several others. Wherever virtue is valued, the older are ranked above the younger, teachers above their pupils, benefactors above those who have benefited from them, rulers above the ruled, and masters above slaves. Parents, then, are placed in the higher rank, for they are elders, guides, benefactors, rulers, and masters, while sons and daughters occupy the lower one, being younger, pupils, recipients of benefits, and subjects and servants. That none of this is a false claim is evident from plain experience, and the arguments from reason set an even stronger seal upon the truth. I say, then, that the maker is always older than the thing made, and the cause older than that of which it is the cause. Parents are, in a sense, the causes and craftsmen of their children. Some of them also hold the rank of teachers, insofar as they happen to have the knowledge to instruct their children from the very beginning of life, imprinting reasoning upon young minds not only in the sciences, but also, most essentially, in the choosing and avoiding that matters most, choosing the virtues, avoiding the vices and their corresponding acts. Who could be greater benefactors than a child's own parents, who brought them out of non-existence, then thought them worthy of nourishment, and after that of an education for both body and soul, so that they might not merely live, but live well. The body they benefited through gymnastic and athletic training, giving it strength, good condition, and ease of movement and posture, never without rhythm and propriety. The soul they benefited through letters and numbers, geometry and music, and philosophy as a whole, which lifts the mind, housed though it is in a mortal body, up on high and carries it as far as heaven, displaying there the blessed and happy natures it contains, and instilling at the same time both zeal and longing for that changeless, harmonious order, which never departs from obedience to its commander. Beyond these benefits, parents also receive the authority they hold over those they begot not as officials in cities receive theirs, by lot or by vote, so that one might blame chance for a slip made without reasoning, and the other blame the drift of the crowd, a thing never examined or considered, but by the finest and most perfect judgment of the higher nature, by which both divine and human affairs are administered with justice. For this reason, parents are permitted both to reproach their children and to admonish them, and, if they do not yield to threats spoken aloud, to strike them, to humiliate them, and to bind them. But if, even against this, they turn stubborn, throwing off restraint under the impulse of an incurable depravity, the law allows punishment even to the point of death, though no longer at the hands of the father alone or the mother alone, because of the magnitude of the penalty, which ought to be judged not by one but by both together. For it is not likely that both parents would agree on the destruction of their child unless the wrongs weighed on them and dragged them down with some fixed, overpowering force that overcame the settled goodwill implanted by nature. parents received not only authority and headship over their children, but also outright mastery, corresponding to both of the highest categories by which servants are acquired, those born in the household and those bought with money. For parents lay out sums many times the ordinary value, for their children and on their children's behalf, to nurses, tutors, and teachers, quite apart from what is spent on clothing, food, and every other kind of care in health and in sickness, from earliest age to full maturity. And those born in the household would be not only those actually born there, but also those whom the household's masters have, by contributing what is needed for their birth, brought into being under nature's ordinances as a necessary contribution. Given so many grounds, then, those who honor their parents do nothing that deserves praise, since even one of the things mentioned would be enough by itself to call for reverence toward them. But blame, accusation, and the highest penalty of justice fall on those who show no respect for them as elders, no acceptance of them as guides, no gratitude toward them as benefactors, no obedience toward them as rulers, and no wariness toward them as masters. Honor your father, it says, and your mother, next after God, binding them with the second place honors that nature itself has assigned them in setting the contest's prizes. And you will honor them best of all by striving to be good, and not merely to seem good, the one aim seeking virtue itself, unadorned and unfeigned, the other seeking a good reputation and the praise of those around you. For parents who care little for their own advantage regard their children's nobility of character as the very goal of happiness, a nobility through which their children will also be willing to obey what is commanded of them and to be persuaded in everything just and beneficial. For a true father will never guide his child toward anything foreign to virtue. One might find evidence of reverence toward parents not only in what has been said, but also in the respect shown to people of their age. For whoever reveres an old man or an old woman with no family connection to him seems, in some sense, to be reminded of his own father and mother, looking to them as archetypes and setting these others up as their images. For this reason, it is prescribed in the sacred writings not only that the young must yield the seat of honor to the old, but that they must also rise when their elders pass by, honoring gray hair out of reverence for old age, a state which those who claim this privilege hope one day to reach themselves. It also seems to me an excellent piece of legislation where it says, "Let each person fear his father and his mother," Lev. 19:3, placing fear before goodwill, not as the better of the two, but as more useful and more advantageous for the present occasion. First, because those still being educated and admonished are necessarily still foolish, and folly is cured by nothing so well as fear. Second, it would not have suited a lawgiver's precepts to teach children the goodwill they owe their parents, since nature demands this of its own accord, unbidden, and implants it in the souls of those so joined by birth from the very cradle. Therefore, he left the affection owed to one's parents alone, as something self-taught and needing no command, but he does command fear, on account of those who tend toward carelessness. For when parents, moved by excessive affection, indulge their children and lavish good things on them from every side, sparing them every hardship and danger, bound as they are by the compelling forces of goodwill, some children do not receive this excessive affection to their benefit. Instead, having grown fond of luxury and softness, admiring a soft life while wasting away in body and soul, and letting no part of their own powers stand upright, they trip up and unstring those powers without shame, precisely because they no longer fear the correcting hand of father or mother, giving way and slackening the reins to their own desires. It is therefore necessary to counsel these parents as well, that they use firmer and weightier admonitions to check the current of their children's ways, and to counsel the children too, that they hold their parents in fear and awe as rulers, and, by nature, as masters. For only in this way will they hesitate to do wrong. I have now gone through the five headings of laws contained in the first tablet, and the particular laws referable to each of them. It remains also to set out the punishments established for their transgression. Death is the common penalty across all these offenses, on account of the kinship the wrongs bear to one another, though the grounds for the sentence differ. Let us begin with the last of them, the offense against parents, since discussion of it is already fresh in mind. If anyone strikes his father or his mother, it says, let him be stoned, and quite justly, for it is not right that one who abuses those responsible for his life should himself go on living. But some fine-robed lawgivers, looking more to reputation than to truth, have made a show of refinement by prescribing, for those who strike their parents, the amputation of their hands, thinking it fitting, so as to win applause from the more careless and unreflective, that the very limbs with which they struck their parents should be mutilated. It is foolish to be angry at the instruments of service rather than at those responsible for the act. For it is not hands that commit the outrage, but the outrageous men who act through their hands, and it is they who must be punished. Unless we are also to acquit murderers who used a sword, and instead throw the sword itself beyond the border, and, conversely, refuse honors to those who distinguished themselves in war, giving them instead to the lifeless suits of armor by which they performed their brave deeds. Or will they also attempt, for those who win the stadium, the double course, or the long-distance race, or the boxing match, or the pancration, to crown only the legs and hands, passing over the athlete's whole bodies? It would be laughable to introduce such practices, punishing or honoring parts apart from the whole to which they belong. For we do not, when someone displays skill on flute or lyre and performs superbly, pass over the instruments, and yet still think the player worthy of proclamation and honors. Why then, noble lawgivers, would you need to cut off the hands of those who strike their fathers? So that, besides being wholly useless from then on, they might also exact from those they wronged a levy, not annual but daily, of the food they need, being now unable to provide for themselves. For no father is so hard of heart as to look on while his son dies of hunger, especially once time has dimmed his anger. Even if such a person does not raise his hands, but merely reviles those he is bound to speak well of, or in some other way does something dishonoring his parents, let him die. For he is a common enemy, and, to speak the truth, an executioner of all mankind, since who else could he ever treat with kindness, when he shows none even to those responsible for his life, to whom he owes his very existence, being, as it were, an addition to them. Again, whoever profanes the sacred seventh day shall, so far as it depends on him, be liable to death. For, on the contrary, profane matters and profane persons must be given abundant means of purification toward a better change, since, as someone has said, envy stands outside the divine chorus. But to dare to falsify and adulterate what has been consecrated shows overwhelming impiety. In that ancient migration out of Egypt, when the whole multitude was journeying through a trackless wilderness, and the seventh day came, those many tens of thousands I mentioned earlier stayed quietly in their tents. But one man, not among the neglected or the unnoticed, giving little thought to what had been ordained and mocking those who kept watch, went out to gather sticks, an act that in effect amounted to a demonstration of lawlessness. So he turned back with his arms full, but the people who had poured out of their tents, though they were already provoked, did nothing rash on account of the sacred character of the day. Instead, they brought the impious man to the ruler and reported the offense. He put him under guard, and when an oracle came forth ordering the man to be stoned, he handed him over for destruction to those who had first seen him. For I think, just as it is not permitted to kindle fire on the seventh day, for the reason I gave earlier, so too it is not permitted to gather fuel for fire. For those who call God to witness to something untrue, the penalty fixed is death, and rightly so. For not even a decent human being would ever tolerate being asked to co-sign a falsehood. Rather, he would, I think, regard as a faithless enemy the one who urged him to do such a thing. Hence it must be said, the one who swears falsely for an unjust cause will never be released from his guilt by God, who is by nature gracious, for he remains defiled and impure, even if he escapes punishment at human hands. But he will never escape it, for there are countless overseers, zealots for the laws, most exact guardians of ancestral custom, who act mercilessly to see that such a man is stoned, unless perhaps, while dishonoring one's father or mother is worthy of death, dishonoring, at the hands of the impious, a name more venerable even than that dignity should be treated more leniently. But no one is so foolish as to kill for lesser offenses while letting the guilty go free for greater ones. And greater than the impiety committed against parents who are slandered and insulted is that committed, through false swearing, against the sacred title of God. But if the one who swears improperly is culpable, how great a punishment does the one deserve who denies the God who truly exists and honors the things that have come into being above the one who made them, and thinks it right to worship not only earth or water or air or fire, the elements of the universe, or again sun and moon and planets and fixed stars, or the whole heaven and cosmos, but even the wood and stone that mortal craftsmen have fashioned, shaped into human-like forms. Therefore let him make himself like the things wrought by hand, for it is right that the one who has honored soulless things should himself have no share in soul, especially if he has become a disciple of Moses, from whom he has often heard, spoken, and prophesied those most sacred and heaven-sent instructions. You shall not admit the name of other gods into your soul for remembrance, nor interpret it with your voice. Rather, having separated both mind and speech far from all else, turn them toward the Father and Maker of all things, so that you may think the best and finest thoughts about his sole sovereignty, and speak what is fitting and most beneficial both for yourself and for those who will hear you. The punishments for those who transgress the five oracles have now been set forth. As for the rewards laid up for those who keep them, even if the law has not announced them in explicit commands, still they are shown by way of implication. Now, not believing in other gods, not fashioning gods of wrought material, and not swearing falsely have no need of any other reward. For the very practice of these things is itself, I think, the best and most perfect reward. For on what could a lover of truth take greater delight than in devoting himself to the one God and clinging, without deceit and in purity, to his service? And I call as witnesses not those who worship vanity, but those who have pursued unerring zeal, among whom truth is honored. For wisdom's own reward is wisdom itself, and justice and each of the other virtues is its own reward. But piety, which, as in a chorus, is the most beautiful and leads all the rest, is far more than its own contest and prize, for it grants to those who practice it happiness, and to their children and descendants blessings that cannot be taken away. Again, those who keep the sacred seventh day happen to be benefited in the two most essential things, body and soul. The body by rest from continuous and unwearied labors, the soul by the best conceptions of God as the maker of the world who cares for what he has begotten. For indeed he brought all things to completion in 7 days. It is clear from this, then, that the one who honors the seventh day is found to be honoring the Maker himself. In like manner, let the one who honors his parents not go hunting for anything further, for he will find, on examining the deed itself, that it carries its own reward. Nevertheless, since this fifth commandment, because it touches on mortal things, falls short of the first four, which were allotted a more divine portion, he offered consolation by saying, "Honor your father so that it may go well with you and that you may live long." Exodus 20:12, setting down two rewards. One is a share in virtue, for to fare well is virtue, or is not apart from virtue. The other, if the truth must be told, is a kind of immortality achieved through a long span of years and a lifetime of many days, which you will nourish, even while still in the body, with a soul that has been purified by a perfect purification. This, then, has been said sufficiently. The matters in the second tablet after these, we shall examine when opportunity allows.